Hello, this is Lewis Leader on National Public Radio Station KAZU on the Monterey Bay. And we're here interviewing Joe Williams. Joe is a candidate for the 20th Congressional District seat, which will be open in the June 7th election. Veteran Congressman Sam Farr has decided not to seek re-election. Hi, Joe. How are you today?
I'm great, Lewis. Thanks for the invite.
And thanks for coming. Let me just give you a little background. Joe's one of five candidates. Jimmy Panetta's on the Democratic slate or line. Casey Lucius is running as a Republican. Jack Digby is running as an independent. Barbara Honegger is running as an independent, and Joe Williams is running on Peace and Freedom. The top two candidates on June 7th will advance to the November election. Let me tell you a little about Joe. He lives in Santa Cruz. He's a hospital healthcare professional, specifically a laboratory technician. He loves to surf and kayak. He's a counselor on military issues at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. He's a union steward for the SEIU union, specifically he's with United Healthcare Workers. He's a delegate to the Monterey Bay Central Labor Council, Santa Cruz County Peace and Freedom Party Central Committee member for the last dozen years, and he ran against Sam Farr in 2004. He's also a Bernie Sanders candidate, and those people are known as Bernie-crats. That's an interesting resume. Joe, what have I missed?
Well, I'm leaving out some things that may not be relevant. I did a bunch of community radio efforts back in the 90s, and I like to think some of our efforts led to the low-power FM stations that are now on the air across the country. So I don't want to get too heavy into that, but we did a lot of pushing the FCC to make some room.
Joe, you ran against Farr in 2004. This is an open seat. Why did you decide to run again?
Well, there's three things. I think the first one is I asked people if they wanted me to run, and so I put my name out there as a candidate and asked people to crowdfund me on the ballot, and lo and behold, I had no idea that people would actually pony up the money, but they did, and here I am. So that was my first criteria, do you want me to run? And I think and that leads to the somewhat into the second reason is that there were no other Democrats entering the race. So the top of the list was Bill Monning. He was, I guess, on the short list to throw his hat in the ring and didn't. And the Panetta name evidently was too formidable for the rest of the local Democrats like Stone or Laird or Alejo. And folks in Santa Cruz, I think, took a look at that and said, no, we need somebody to the left of Jimmy to at least, you know, keep him honest. So that is the second reason. The third is due to the Bernie Sanders being in the race and bringing socialism back into the public lexicon and up for discussion, and given that I'm a Peace and Freedom Party member or an explicitly socialist feminist party, it seemed like the time might be right to engage the conversation again.
Third parties historically have not done that well in the United States. The last third-party candidate to get any electoral votes was George Wallace in 68 on the American Independent Party. We've had other third-party candidates, Ross Perot, John Anderson as an independent, et cetera. I want to get a little bit into the whole issue with third-party candidacies in the United States. But many would say Peace and Freedom has no chance of winning this seat. Is that a daunting task? Do you think that's an unrealistic statement?
Well, I think the way it is now, I have a better chance than ever again because of the entrance of Bernie Sanders in the race and talking about socialism. As far as on the presidential level, obviously Peace and Freedom is only on the ballot in California. So we're on no other state. So if you're talking presidential politics, then obviously we don't factor in very much at all. But here, since we're now a top two state, all I need to do is come in second.
Okay.
To advance from June to November. So that's a lot easier of a goal than when I ran against Farr in 2004 to actually like beat the field of five. Right now, I just have to beat a field of four.
I've read your material. What do you see and what are you campaigning on as the major issues in this campaign?
Well, I like to extrapolate just from like what I do in my daily life. So I like to kind of pin that to my work at the hospital. So being a laboratory technician takes me to every corner of the hospital, including the emergency room, where I'm at quite a bit. So healthcare. And again, to reference off Bernie, Medicare for all, single payer, universal health care, that kind of thing. I see the effects of the healthcare industry in this country, and I think it needs complete revamping. So healthcare is the top of my list due to that. It's also my work as a steward, representing workers against management. So I guess my second priority would be strong unions. Let's revitalize the organized labor in this country. Again, that references back to my being an appointed delegate to the Monterey Bay Central Labor Council as well. That factors into things like we just got the $15 an hour minimum wage here in California, and listeners may or may not know that that signature gathering effort was solely done by SEIU-UHW. Interestingly enough, there were two competing initiatives trying to get signatures to qualify for the ballot. Another one was done by other SEIU locals. It did not make the signature threshold. Ours did, and Governor Brown specifically referenced that initiative as being a main impetus to pass that legislation. The third top priority would be peace activism, anti-war activism, if you will. I think we've had 15 years of this war on terror with no end in sight, and given my work doing military counseling at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, it's also very high on my priority list.
Joe, you're with the Service Employees International Union. Which hospital do you work at?
I'm at Dominican Hospital in Santa Cruz.
Okay. Talking about the war on terrorism, per se, what's your assessment of that, and if you were elected to Congress, what would you attempt to do?
Well, at this point, I think I would scale back. On the campaign trail, I've actually called for a 10-year moratorium on war. I'm taking a look at going everything we've tried so far, going back to when we went into Afghanistan in late 2001, up until now, nothing's gotten better. In fact, everything's gotten worse. So my takeaway from that assessment is what we're doing is not working. We need to try something else. So military approach to this, you know, firing more bullets, firing more missiles, blowing things up, seem to be real good at that, but we don't have any exit plan in place. And in fact, most plans say, well, this is an endless war on terror. It will never end. This is just our new normal until the end of time. I don't accept that. I think there's other things that we have yet to try. There's other studies out there that point to different approaches. And I think if we stop with the military approach, at least for 10 years, seems to be a good amount of time to give it some space to breathe and space to work, we might come up with a different outcome.
What's your take on the Homeland Security aspect of the federal government?
Well, I don't really appreciate the way we're being surveilled and the way the law enforcement tends to view us as the enemy nowadays.
When you say us, you're talking about the American populace?
American populace. ICE is now under Homeland Security, and so we've got essentially the nascent beginnings of a police state. Some might argue it's already here, especially in regards to immigration enforcement. I mean, Homeland Security is now, you know, kicking in doors in the middle of the night, rounding up people, separating families, deporting people, herding them into private for-profit detention centers, things like that. I don't appreciate that, so I would do whatever I can to scale that back and protect people who need protection.
You were talking about health care, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. What's your take on that? Is it something that was good, that didn't go far enough? How would you like to expand or change that?
Well, again, referencing through the union, so SEIU did a lot of work on that. We were out there registering people undercover California, and I think personally, I think the ACA is a step in the right direction. Anything that's going to give people more health care rather than less, I think, is a good thing. What I find fault with that is it seems to be just a big payoff to insurance companies, and so I don't appreciate that aspect. Plus, not everybody's covered. Deductibles are really high. It's not going to cover every... it's not going to cover every issue that you need medically. So I want to take it beyond, let's remove the profit from the situation and cover everybody equally.
The GOP has made dozens of efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. If the Republicans win the White House in November, do you think they would continue to do that, especially if they also held on to the House and the Senate?
Well, I'm sure the Republicans are a pretty intransigent group nowadays, so I expect them to do all manner of crazy things. So they need to be opposed as much as possible. And I'm just to be clear, I'm not in favor of repealing the ACA, but I want to let's take a look at it, revamp it, and move it forward to where it needs to be.
Historically, third parties, I mentioned earlier, have had a difficult time in this country. Yet you go back to the turn of the 20th century, Eugene Victor Debs ran five times for president. In 1912, he got 6% of the vote, which was quite a high figure considering you also had Wilson, Taft, and Teddy Roosevelt in the race. And then he ran again in 1920 from prison. In those days, socialism was accepted as within the norm of political spectrum. What's evolved in this country is that socialism has been equated in many factors with evil, and it's been a long time since a socialist person has gotten such a following. And it's intriguing that Bernie Sanders, as a socialist or socialist Democrat, is doing so well. To what do you attribute that?
Well, there's two things. I think when we saw the internal dissolution of the Soviet Union, you watch that crumble of its own internal weight. So I think what got discredited there was the top down take over the government, nationalize all the industries, and then tell people what to do. So I think that's the memory of most people have, and that's the kind of socialism at least an older generation tends to view. The younger generation tends to view it through the lens of the Bernie Sanders type view, where it's people coming together and working from the bottom up. It's if you're going to have it's socialism from below versus socialism from above, to make a very clear distinction on that.
Is the emergence of socialism as a realistic political force in the United States, or at least the candidacy of Bernie Sanders? Do you think that's in part because of the increasing disparity we have in the country between the richest and the poorest, and the percentage of wealth that the top 1% has in the country? Is there a political sensing in the country that it isn't working?
Oh, definitely. I have to agree with all that. The wealth gap, if you will, and Bernie likes to talk about the 1%. I mean, that was right out of the Occupy Wall Street thing, so he's using that language, which I think has struck a chord and continues to strike a chord across this country when people look at their future and understand that they're not going to have as good of a future as past generations have had. So in terms of whether socialism has any chance of success, I think you can look at least on a local level, Kashama Sawant up in Seattle on the city council up there. She's very out socialist, put together basically a labor environmental coalition, and got herself elected to the local city council. And she's a big Bernie supporter as well. Thinks we need to kind of go beyond electoral politics, and we do need to organize outside the system as well as in the system. So I agree with that, but it does show the potential for at least on a local level candidates to actually run and win office.
Historically, socialism in this country has not done that well. The German Werner Sombart wrote the book "Why Is There No Socialism in the United States" about 100 years ago. And it was the conclusion that the U.S. was a very prosperous country and working people could make it in a generation or two, and therefore there was not a need for socialism. Has that changed now?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I think you're seeing it in the recognition of the young people that have flocked to Sanders' campaign, whether it's looking at the debt they're saddled with from student loans, whether they're looking at the job market out there, and they just don't see anything that's going to give them a higher standard of living than their parents, let's say. For a variety of factors like that, I think that's why people are looking for a fairness as well, because where's all that wealth going? You just had that recent release here, the Panama Papers, and all the rich folks are stashing their money in offshore accounts overseas. It's like, hey, where did that money come from? Well, that workers made that. You know, capitalists survive off the back of labor. So labor created that wealth, and then that wealth is not trickling down at all. It's been funneled full spigot on offshore. So anything we can do to bring that back and use that for people's needs, I think people recognize that as the right approach.
One of the issues in American history, it seems that the left often comes up with ideas and then the Democratic Party adapts them and makes them part of government policy. I'm talking about FDR, Social Security, the Farm Labor Standards Act, Works Progress Administration, child labor laws, and more recently, the civil rights legislation of the mid-60s, and now the $15 minimum raise, which a few years ago probably wouldn't have gotten off the ground. So in effect, does the left succeed even if it doesn't elect its people because many of its key points become part of the United States government policy?
Well, yes. I think you see that most concretely in the fight for 15. Mentioned it earlier, but maybe it bears revisiting in that here you have a local union. I mean, we're only here in California, putting this initiative on the ballot and then having a governor say, like, without this initiative, I would not be signing this legislation here today. In fact, he vetoed it a couple years ago when Luis Alejo was in the assembly and introduced it, said nope, and made it all the way to the governor's desk, and he said no. So what's changed? It's people from the bottom organizing and saying, hey, we want this regardless of what you guys think in the high offices of the land. We're going to push this forward. So is the legislation that was just signed by Governor Brown a little less than we would have liked? Does it match our initiative proposal exactly? Well, no, it doesn't. But it's a step in the right direction, and that's the way the political game is played. So, yes, you work from outside the system. You force the changes that you'd like to see within the system, and you declare victory when you can.
Turning again to foreign affairs, one of the planks of the Peace and Freedom Party is to abolish the CIA and others, to withdraw U.S. troops and weapons from other countries. Another is no drones for killing or invasion of privacy, convert from a military to a peace-oriented economy with jobs for displaced workers. Given the tenor of some of the violence in the world, talking about what happened in Paris, Brussels, Turkey, and San Bernardino, how can you do that and yet secure or make certain the security of American people?
Well, I think we need to look at maybe redefine our definition of security. What is actually going to be making us safe? And I would propose that everything that we've been doing in terms of interference in sovereign governments and invasion of sovereign territory without countries' consent via these drone strikes, invasion wherever, whenever, and wherever we want based on what we consider our national security, which I don't think is the public's security. I think it's security for arms manufacturers. I think it's security for military contractors to keep an endless supply of weapons and material funneled into these places, and they can continue to reap profits. So, not to avoid the question, but it's like that is not working. That is leading to disaster. That's leading to people in these other countries winding up hating us. So the more we continue to do that, the more hate we will engender. So anything we can do that moves us out of this permanent war footing where boots on the ground are called for, or more drone strikes, or, you know, assassination, high-level targets, this kind of thing has seemed to have been our approach. It's not going to work.
One of the Peace and Freedom Party planks, and you also talked about it, is the removal of American military overseas. I presume that would include Okinawa, South Korea, Germany, and elsewhere. Let's just say the United States followed through on that. Mm-hmm. Do you think the countries that have relied on us over time would be greatly concerned, particularly, say, on the Korean Peninsula?
Well, I suppose it depends. You're going to take a case by case. I think overall our presence there, I mean, maybe I should preface this with a story. You mentioned Okinawa, you mentioned South Korea. So I played music in the 80s in Hawaii.
What do you play, by the way?
Keyboards.
Okay.
A professional level keyboard player, still play in a band. But when I was over there, so Oahu has about 25% of its landmass basically under the control of the United States military. So at the time, you know, I'm kind of a dumb kid, you know, go over there, do my thing. I didn't think anything of it. It was just, we played the enlisted men's club. So, you know, it was a form of income for me. Kind of like, look, you kind of see what goes on. Oh, well, then you start looking into like, well, why is the United States here? And doesn't this land belong to the native Hawaiians anyway? Why have they been displaced and pushed to these basically uninhabitable portions of the island and are destitute and their health is so poor? You start looking at things like that. And you start going, what's going on here? In conjunction with that, we did a military tour of Japan. We were played the Yokosuka Naval Base outside of Tokyo. We went down to and played the Iwakuni Air Station outside of Hiroshima. I got to visit the Peace Park there. Quite sobering. When you stand where right ground zero where the atomic bomb fell. And then we also went to Okinawa for 2 months. We played Marine camps on the island. So Okinawa is a very good example to kind of look at, because right now today, and in fact yesterday, there's a giant protest out in front of Camp Foster. So Okinawans have been protesting the U.S. presence in their country. It's Japan, but they don't like Japan either. They've been under occupation by the Japanese and now the United States for forever, or at least since World War II. So they want us out. You watch the signs, you pull up the news, Marines out. Now, why do the Okinawans want the Marines out? It's because our service members prey on the local population and prey on the women there. So there's rapes of Japanese tourists. They import Filipino women there to work in hostess bars outside the bases. And we need to clear out. So whether it's South Korea, whether it's, you know, formerly the Philippines, all these places that you say, we don't bring a positive element into these other countries. And I think we should withdraw.
One of the local issues you've discussed is deals with Driscoll's, the large berry distributor, the world's largest. Tell me your perspective on that, what's going on, and maybe let me just give some background. Driscoll's has been criticized. There have been pickets there. It's in Watsonville. There's been a call for boycott of the berries. KAZU had a piece a while ago, and the feeling is that, and correct me from your perspective if you disagree, it has to do with the Sakuma Brothers Farms, which is a supplier of Driscoll's, and the right for workers to unionize there. And some people feel that Driscoll's should be putting some pressure or encouraging Sakuma to have a workers' union contract there. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, sure. And I think you also have to look across the border, too. A lot of this is, you know, got to do with what's going on in Mexico. So we're talking cross-border organized labor attempts as well.
People, Driscoll's has a reputation as a pretty fair, socially responsible, and their perspective is that it isn't the company's place to tell workers at the Sakuma plant in Washington either to unionize or not unionize. And of course, it's more difficult in Washington to unionize because they don't have the equivalent of, say, the California Agricultural Labor Relations Act. Mm-hmm. So is this a key point of your campaign? Is this an ancillary point? What's your perspective?
Well, I think, you know, as a socialist, I think you can look at any battle and see, like, who is on the bottom and who's being harmed, who is hurting, and who needs to have their condition improved. So in that sense, I think you'll find socialists across the border always going to be on the side of the workers trying to improve their position, whether it's in this country or whether it's down in Mexico. So this point, it's a two-country effort. It's got to do with Baja California and Mexico, and it's got to do with stuff up here. So yes, completely, it was a main plank. I mean, whatever I can do, if say as a congressman, if elected, I would definitely use the so-called bully pulpit to trumpet the rights of the workers to ask for what they want, and also the right of the public to join in the boycott and in order to try to move those changes forward.
Let's talk about your own political growth. You were born in Torrance, Southern California. How did you move in what directions, and how did you begin to espouse the political perspectives you have now?
Well, I think it came of political awakening in Orange County. So we lived in Yorba Linda. My dad actually had the Yorba Linda Veterinary Hospital. So my first exposure to politics was through him going to, you know, the local chamber meetings, the Rotary Club, and things like that. You know, just understanding, like, well, how does this work? Who are you giving money to here? And, like, how's this game played, right? So I immediately look at, like, Orange County's pretty white. So it's my awakening is like, well, what's going on here? It's all white people. It's all rich people. And the only game in town was the Republicans. So Yorba Linda is the birthplace of Richard Nixon. That's where the Richard Nixon Memorial Library is. My dad's lawyer had a picture of himself on the wall shaking hands with Richard Nixon. So my first exposure to any of this was campaigning for Ronald Reagan in 1980. There was no other game in town. I wanted to know what was going on, so that's what I did. Within a very short amount of time, you kind of recognize what's going on and say, "What's going? This doesn't make any sense here, right? What's going on?" So
let me interrupt. Was there an epiphany moment? Was there something you read or learned, or something that happened?
I don't know if I can point to one particular thing, but sitting there and calling up, you know, sitting there on the phone banking for Reagan in the 80s and trying to get rich people to, like, give money to Reagan, and then at the same time looking into, like, Reagan, where did he come from, what's his background, and I started looking at that and going, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. So I think when I stopped volunteering and stopped phone banking for Reagan was based on actually figuring out what Reagan represented, what he represented, and looking a little bit more into his past and not liking what I saw.
Let's go back a little bit. You're in the mid-50s in age, so you were born in, what, 60, 61?
Early 60s.
Early 60s, okay. Peace and freedom began really to become a force in response to the Vietnam War. 66, 67, 68 ran its first presidential candidate. It was somewhat of a hotbed of a political movement on California colleges. I was in college then, and it was seen as an alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans. The Democratic convention in 1968 was very chaotic, and the Republicans nominated Nixon. Has the Peace and Freedom Party, has it kind of stayed at that level? You know, why do you feel it has not emerged as a stronger third party, as no third party has emerged in this state? Or
well, I think it's a lot of factors. One is I think people are not really aware of the alternative parties out there. I think if we moved, and I advocate this, public funding of elections, and so does Bernie Sanders, where independents, greens, you know, socialists, whatever stripe have you, if we had, like, equal access in terms of putting our name out there, I think people would be drawn to it. You know, a lot more than they are now. So as far as the Peace and Freedom Party, where it started came out of the tumult of the 60s, and so I appreciate that reference point to back then, because that tumult, I think, is what we need to kind of return to, you know, masses of people in the streets, masses of people agitating for change. But what you see now is the Peace and Freedom Party, it's a multi-tendency party. So they just kind of, like, offer themselves as kind of an umbrella group for all stripes of socialists and communists, leftists, what have you, to actually to run on. I think I'm one of the few that actually champions the current platform as written. Some of the people who are on our presidential party ballot or come from other little socialist groupings and kind of have their own platforms, which is fine, and Peace and Freedom just wants to stay on the ballot, have that access, and provide a means for socialists to run for office in California.
Speaking of tumult, what's your take on the Donald Trump campaign?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't like the guy. I don't think he should be anywhere near the levers of power. That said, I'm kind of perplexed at what kind of game he's playing, because he's been registered Democrat in the past. You can look online. He's buddies with the Clintons going way back. They were social functions and weddings and things like that. They appeared all together. So I'm not sure what to make of him. As it stands, as the words come out of his mouth, he's racist, he's sexist, he's this. He's got no business being near the presidency at all. So I oppose him 100% in terms of putting him in any position of power in this country.
Would you hazard a guess as what might happen to the GOP as we know it if Trump gets the nomination?
I'd love to see it completely implode. They have long ago, and the Democrats aren't far behind, kind of moved away from what I consider like the average American's concerns. I mean, they're obviously a party of the rich, a party of the corporations, and they make that very clear. So I'd like to see the Republican Party just splinter into irrelevancy, to tell you the truth.
Now, Trump has drawn in a lot of alienated people on the right, or as you said, is it really the right? Or, you know, we just don't know. It's many of these people have never voted before. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders is bringing in people who have, my word, maybe been alienated from the existing political system. What do you attribute Bernie's rise to? What do you attribute it?
Well, you touched on it earlier. I mean, the extreme wealth inequality in this country, I think, is hard to ignore. Banks that get bailed out, corporations that get bailed out with taxpayer money, yet when it comes down to people's needs, we get the shaft. We're told to cut back. We just recently threw a few hundred thousand more people off food stamps a day or two ago. I think people see this. You know, they're hurting on the bottom, and they see the rich people, you know, having the time of their life. Nobody's going to jail. Nobody's being prosecuted. It's unfair. I think people have a keen sense of fairness about this, and they look at why are we, meaning the average American, being treated so poorly, and why are the people who have so much being treated so regally? It needs to change.
You talk about the average American being treated poorly. How does that manifest itself, say, on a daily or weekly basis? How do you feel Americans are so such impacted?
Well, I think you have I think I like to reference that off of the organized labor. You're winding up with a smaller and smaller organized labor movement in this country. There's been some movement in the South, so there's been some gains in certain places. But the power of the worker to stand up in the workplace and actually demand a decent working environment, a proper schedule, no mandatory overtime, you know, things that kind of the labor movement has instituted and people have been taken for granted due to the labor movement's advocacy in this country. So what you see now is at-will employees, independent contractors, no job security, no access to health care, these types of things. And these are the things that people are worried about. If you don't have health care for your family and your kids and spouse and whatnot, it's going to cause you stress. And I think people look at that and go, there's no reason why we can't have that if every other major developed country in the world has that. What's wrong?
The percentage of workers in organized labor continues to diminish in this country, AFL-CIO. Mm-hmm. Is part of that labor failing to do what it needs to do and failing to educate the working class?
Well, I think so, but I also see positive developments. You're seeing the Fight for 15 is going to, I think, energize. That's moved to New York now and other states. AFL-CIO is right on top of that. They recognize the importance of that. They're going to throw some time, energy, and effort into that, and I think that's kind of the way to go. If they have to be pushed the same way other organizations need to be pushed, at least in terms of government, then we can do the same. They also recently announced about mass incarceration. They've come out against mass incarceration, say it's workers' issues, because people come out and they're going to come back into society. What do? Let's train them. Let's make them union workers. Let's make them productive members of society. So I think there's some innovative things coming out of the AFL-CIO, and it bears watching in the coming months and years.
This is Lewis Leader on National Public Radio Station KAZU 90.3. We're interviewing Joe Williams. He is the Peace and Freedom Party candidate for the 20th Congressional District seat in the June 7th 11th. It's a seat that longtime Democratic Congressman Sam Farr is stepping away from, not seeking a re-election. Joe, let me turn a little bit now to the tax codes and the income tax rates. I'm just going to do a little background here. Between 1953 and 1961, when the very popular Dwight Eisenhower was president, the highest tax rate, and this may surprise some people, was 91%. And now the highest tax rate, and that was on the last dollar made, so it wasn't like it was 91% entirely. And now the tax rates, I think the highest now is a little under 40%. Yet, it seems to be the conversation in this country is that many people feel we're being overly taxed. What's your take?
Well, I think when it you make a distinction between people and then corporations, right? So it depends, right? I think that's the short answer. But when it comes to people, I'm all for, you know, reducing the average worker's tax burden, but I'm also for increasing corporations' tax burden. I think when you create these tax loopholes for corporations to move offshore, move overseas, gut jobs in this country, and then I mean, Walmart's the perfect example, and then pay people minimum wage or below, and then you have Walmart workers on food stamps. So where's the fairness here? So I think the call is to have them pay what I guess would consider to be their fair share. I mean, whether it goes back to Eisenhower's 91%, I'm not sure, but it's got to be more than it is now.
Citizens United was a ruling by the Supreme Court, which basically said that a corporation is a person and that could give as much money as through a PAC. Proponents of that say, well, you know, this allows people, corporations, big unions to spend money and further the cause of their candidates. Opponents say it really has tipped the scales and you can now buy elections per se. Peace and Freedom, Joe Williams, your perspective.
Yeah, well, it's $1, one vote. That's what we have currently. That's not a workable system. So back to public funding of elections, I think you would like at least take some of that out. I'm completely for repealing Citizens United, echoing Bernie again on that. I don't think that even allowing the unions, of which I'm a big supporter of, we will never be able to match, you know, giant corporations' contributions or all these other lobbyists, arms, especially the arms manufacturers and military contractors, especially when it comes to the Pentagon budget specifically. Until you take that influence out, until our elections are not able to be bought and sold to the highest bidder, we're going to continue in the situation we have.
The Supreme Court now is with 8 members. Obama has brought forth a candidate, Garland, who is certainly not a far left winger, has some moderate issues, probably to the left of center. The Republicans have said no, they want the people to decide. They want to wait until the presidential election is determined in November. Your perspective on that?
Well, that's an interesting one. My reading of it, I believe it was McConnell actually kind of challenged Obama to say, you know, well, why don't you appoint this guy, right? Because they've approved him in the past. Republicans were fine with him at one point. And so Obama called his bluff and said, here's this guy, right? So he's kind of center, maybe center-right. I mean, he's definitely, I think, a shrewd nomination by Obama. The unions have come out full favor because he tends to side with the organized labor in some of the rulings that he participated in regarding the National Labor Relations Board. So I'd have to say, at least from that perspective, from an organized labor perspective, he's a great choice. I don't think we need to wait until a new president seated. I think you can look online and find that there's, you know, a handful or more of Supreme Court justices that have been nominated to the seat in a president's final term.
I think one of the things we've learned is that Supreme Court justices can be very independent. Eisenhower once said that the worst decision he made was appointing Warren to the bench, because Warren's track record in California was much more conservative than he came, and he became basically the creator of civil rights enforcement legislation, Brown versus the Board of Education in Kansas. Let me turn back a little bit. What do you disagree with Bernie Sanders about?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot here now. Huh? Okay, well, I think domestic policies, I think I've got his back 100%. I think when it comes to foreign policy, he has said a few things I find troubling, although he's moved more in my direction than the opposite direction. So he has said he would continue Obama's drone program, although he would scale it back to maybe where it would kill less civilians. No, I'm not into that. I want that drone program ended completely, utterly outright yesterday. So, and there's other foreign policy things. He thinks, you know, going into Afghanistan was the right thing. No, the wrong thing. Look where it's got us, nowhere. So I would basically find fault with his foreign policy, anything where he would still want to use the armed military might in an aggressive way overseas, I would be opposed to.
Should we be taking proactive steps to kill people whose goal is to harm the United States, harm Western countries?
No, absolutely not. I mean, this can go back to my work for the last 15 years of the Resource Center for Nonviolence. I think what you learn is violence begets violence, and that's what you see. So look, we have Al Qaeda was the big threat, yada yada yada. Okay, well, pretty much decapacitated them, in terms of top, killed all their leaders. So what took their place? Well, now ISIS took their place. So we're going to decapitate ISIS. So let's assassinate our way out of this problem too, right? There's nothing that I can see. There's no exit. There's no end game here. No exit strategy that I can see where it says, like, we're going to get to a better outcome by killing our way out of this problem. And in fact, I think, we might wind up with somebody even more, terrible than ISIS if this is where we're going to continue.
I'm looking at an interview that the Salinas, California did with you recently, and one of the points, and they paraphrase some of it and directly quote you, it says, Williams urged the crowd, those in attendance, to research the basic income guarantee approach, mm-hmm. quote, it's basically welfare for all, everybody get a check, end of quote, regardless of your circumstances. Can the government pay for that?
Certainly. I think looking at the recent proposal, the People's Budget just put out by the Congressional Progressive Caucus addresses this directly, and it comes right out of the Pentagon budget. So their specifics is to, like, fund it all right away, the Overseas Contingencies Operation Fund, zero that out, take all that money and put it for people's needs. And interestingly enough, the basic income, a universal income, a basic income guarantee was first proposed by Nixon. So it's not this radical of an idea. Other countries have used it in various configurations. And I think it's one of those things where we either move towards that as soon as we can, or else you're gonna lose any sense of capitalism in this country or not, because what basic income does is set a floor, a monetary floor by which no one will fall below. So you want to guarantee that basic income for everybody, then it's like, well, you still have a chance if you're going to get rich or make a lot of money, but you can't do it at the expense of your fellow citizens who are, in poverty and in destitution.
A couple more points, and we can wrap this up. The issue of homelessness, it's mm-hmm. become an issue in Salinas with the Chinatown neighborhood. Homelessness has become at least more visible in American society, whether it's greater or whether we're paying more attention to it. What is your remedy for dealing with the question of homeless people?
Well, obviously, just being running as a socialist, I'm controversial on a lot of issues here. But again, referencing back to my stay in Hawaii. So my last 2 years on Oahu, I worked for the Waikiki Health Center, and I worked for the caravan outreach team. So we went around to homeless folks. We took a nurse. We checked on people's health. We gave them bus passes to come back, see a doctor in the clinic. That program is still ongoing on Oahu. It's a great program. Continues to this day. But what you, at the end of my 2 years, at the end, we did a Housing Now rally. at the state capitol in Honolulu. And the slogan for that rally, and I think it bears repeating today, is one house for everybody before two for anybody. Again, we're looking at like making that floor I'm talking about, whether it's through basic income, education, housing, whatever the things that people need, healthcare, everything, you have a basic floor by which nobody falls below. So provide the housing, right? Why should people be able to own apartment buildings and houses and vacation homes and all this that sit vacant when there's people living on the streets? So that's going to require quite a bit of a change in people's perception in terms of this problem, but I think it's good. One house for everybody before two for anybody.
And the person who has two, three, or four houses, what would happen to him or her?
They would be required to dispose of it in somehow.
Let's go back just a couple other things. In 2004, you ran. Sam Farr, the Democrat, got about 149,000 votes. Risley, the Republican, about 65. The Green Party candidate finished third. You finished fourth with just under 3,000 votes. And then Libertarian was fifth. Has the tenor of the times changed sufficiently enough that you expect you'll do much better?
Well, that's the expectations. I don't know. I'm kind of banking on the Sanders factor here. Right, as the relevancy of the California primaries actually become greater. In the past, usually it's like the nominees have already been set by the time the primaries come out here to California, and traditionally, historically, it suppresses the turnout down out here. In this case, it looks like it's going to go down to the wire with Sanders wins in all these recent primaries. If he does well in New York and Pennsylvania, California is going to be a battleground state. So if young people who are Sanders supporters actually come to the polls, Sanders comes out here and campaigns up and down the state. He did an interview with the LA Times where he basically said, you know, California is going to be sick of me. I'm going to be everywhere. I said, I'm counting on that, and I hope he comes to this area, and I hope his supporters come out. And given the fact that people who support Sanders have also recognized me in terms of being a Sanders Democrat, quote unquote, and also a Bernie-crat, I'm hoping that translates into votes in June.
In your campaign, have you been doing some campaigning with independent candidate Jack Digby, a Capitola ironworker?
I have not. That was guess, thrown out via the media
that
recently.
That's an error. Okay.
We thought about it, and it didn't seem prudent, I guess.
Joe Williams, is there anything else you want to bring up that I haven't asked you?
Well, I think a lot of the work that I do with the Resource Center for Nonviolence, it needs to be championed. If people have a takeaway in terms of like what are the distinctions between me and the top major party candidates in the race, the Democrat and the Republican, is they're basically solidified on war. That's the approach that works. I mean, they're both Navy veterans. They're both laud their military service.
You're talking about Jimmy Panetta and Casey Lucius.
And Casey Lucius, okay. Correct. So the distinctions couldn't be greater because I advocate nonviolent solutions for all this stuff. And so that's going to be the biggest distinction. Do you believe endless war? Do you believe, endless, even if there are jobs making missiles, is this the way are we going to kill our way out of this problem? And I say no. And part of that work that I do at the Resource Center for Violence also entails what we call truth in recruitment or counter-recruitment work, where we go into high schools and actually talk to kids and talk to them about the realities of military service and basically explain to them why they don't need to join the military to pay for school and things like that. So we're actively fighting against the idea that this is the way you approach international problems.
We've been talking with Joe Williams, the Peace and Freedom candidate for Congress in the 20th Congressional District in California. Joe, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Lewis.
For sharing your thoughts with you. This is Lewis Leader for KAZU.